Field interview with Ted Sperry, Bill Jordan, conducted by Bill Jordan, Wednesday, September 12th, 1990, at the Arboretum, out on Curtis Prairie.
Flag is out there. It takes me about half a day to establish one flag.
Oh, yeah?
And then after I get the marker flags, then it goes much faster after that. And I've been able to get about 10 to 15 plots surveyed in a half a day. It runs 20 to 25 plots a day. Do you have any pheasants out here?
Oh, sure. Quite a few sometimes. There's been a group of young ones around the building in the last month or so.
I've seen one.
Here.
There used to be common out here. I was wondering whether they're real common here now or not.
Oh, yeah.
They nest out of this stuff?
I don't know, Ted. I think the pheasants do live in prairies very happily.
Yeah. Most of them used to nest more in the marsh next to the lake.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I know I've seen nests out here. Any hen-tailed sparrows?
I believe so, yeah.
There used to be hen-tailed sparrows when I was planting out here. Most of these birds are goldfinches, I think. Pass the car on this trail here.
Well, I think if you squeezed your car over. Right. But we don't want to be responsible for blocking.
Sure don't. There's enough edge here. You can get by it quite well. But that one. To bring you and Gina. Pretty good savanna here. It's not maintained in the savanna very well yet, but I think it should be. Nice little sun area.
How would you maintain that?
No fire. Mostly. Oh, it's supposed to have a flag right down here someplace. There.
Yeah.
Did a car get by me over there?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Can you get out, Ted?
I think maybe I can squeeze my way out.
Sure they are.
And that was put there. It was 25-2. I think. 3-1.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 25-2 and 27-1. They just looked on through the numbers. There's 27-1 there. Each number represents a particular species.
Mm-hmm.
Planted a particular way. And the 27 is the Baptisia leucophila.
Mm-hmm.
And 27-1 is the first planting of that. 27-2 is the second planting of the same thing.
Right.
And so forth. And I have one, 213 goes up to 13 plantings of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most I have.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly it's just one or two or three, and sometimes just one. That's 25-2, Petalustrum candidum. Now, I'm pretty sure that didn't grow at all. I don't expect to find anything on that. But Baptisia leucantha is the one that just forms solid thickets all over the area. That's the heck of one. But leucophila is rather slow growing and smaller and doesn't provide very much. The competition I haven't found any. Are these signs put up for any special reason or is it? Right, this is awesome.
What, Ted?
Now those signs put up every 1200, right? The Baptistia Lucafia.
Right in this area. Up at the southern end of Curtis Prairie, the high ground between the prairie and the Beltline. Jenna Klein and Ted and Pam and I are visiting some of Ted's plots so that he can show us how he's been doing his survey.
On your map, the pond's over there. The McKay's over there.
Yeah.
And we're headed for this red spot right here.
The red spot.
Mm-hmm.
I laughed. I didn't know whether that was a mosquito bite or a...
The red spot.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. And we're right up in here now.
Nursery plot number 3.
You can't find it anymore. But we grew quite a number of our prairie seeds in the nursery first, and let them grow up and then use
those seeds. Where's the road here?
See, this map was made before the highway is put in.
Where's the fire lane that we're on?
Right about in here.
Okay.
Someplace. As a matter of fact, trying to survey this area is difficult because the old public road is gone here,
mm-hmm.
but they moved the highway. They moved the 6-lane highway and put a curve in, so it comes clear down to here someplace. I don't know where it belongs on this map.
Mm-hmm.
But this was originally at the old forest, but I don't know about it there. Mm-hmm. I've seen those curves. But I have never found just where the highway goes along in here, but some of these plantings are no longer, this is no longer visible, and these are not no longer visible because the road took them off.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Come on, Jenna. Not having known monuments to measure from, not even a road for sure. I determined my locations by the plants, let the plants tell me. And when I came down here, I found here the whole big patch of the echinacea. And you go through the prairie and you don't find echinacea in big patches like that. So these are where they planted. And the echinacea is planting P434 on your map. Got it?
Mm-hmm.
And the echinacea, see it extending the terrace back through there?
Mm-hmm.
And you look here where you've been mowed, and sure enough, it's all the flowering, you can see the flowers here, and here the triangular leaves, characteristic of it.
Yeah.
And so there's the 434. You fall along the edge of the echinacea, you come out here. Over there, New Echinacea.
Right.
There's your boundary land right along there.
Right.
Right up in there.
That's pretty clear.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to illustrate, that the plants tell you where the old plantings were on some species. Some species spread so widely. In fact, the silphium is pretty poor.
So your trick was to locate the corner of this 434.
Yeah. And it didn't make too much difference which corner it was, but I more or less automatically chose that corner over there.
Oh my!
Well, be darned.
By that sign, or that poster.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, this echinacea here has spread here just a little bit. It spreads rather badly. And it's moved down a little bit. I figured the line was probably right about there. And this is spreading, a little spreading out. This is an indication of the old farmland, asparagus. Strictly European plant.
see who quite a bit of a eyeball. You could measure it if you don't know. But the echinacea extends along here quite well. And the map shows you that 33 is adjacent to the echinacea, just to the west side of it. And that's Aster nevus, a lot of pin in there. And so you get over here, where your heavy echinacea disappears, there's scattered plants. Well, you got quite a bit of the Aster nevus. Isn't that what you have, this one? Isn't that
Aster nevus?
Aster nevus. The smooth blue. And you find the Aster nevus through here. 30-3, yeah. And 30 is the Aster designation, and the dash 3 is, this is the third triangle of Aster nevus I put in here. And the other Asters are elsewhere on the arborvitae. So this is the Aster nevus area. It's not as dense as the echinacea, but it's still considerably more dense than it is in much of the rest of the prairie.
Why is this mowed out here?
Because it's sleepover.
Oh.
There's some of the sweet clover. It doesn't kill it off. And checking your planting here, just to the south of the south of the echinacea is this Sophium integrifolium, and south of the Aster nevus is 41-3, which is Sophium terebinthaceum. So let's go down and see what we find. Some of the reasons I brought you out here, because you can walk around on this without having to push through so much grass and see what you're doing. Hang around. I think maybe I have a spot, and then I'm not too sure, but I want to come back to it. So I just take a piece of Kleenex and put it on top of a plant that tells me the spot where it was.
Did you
see it right? See it right there?
Did you plant the gentians in here too?
No, there were no gentians here when I was here. Who brought the gentians in? Where did they come from? No, we had none here at all. I'm delighted that they're here. Wonderful.
Well.
I have no idea of the history of it. You run out of the echinacea right away. But you got the silk in here. The solid through there.
Mm-hmm.
The silkium integrifolium. You see it?
I can see it there and I can see it over here too.
Yeah. In other words,
so we're on the east boundary of it.
No, on the south boundary here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the east boundary is near
yeah.
here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. So you have an idea just where the original planting was. There is the mowed area, and here it is. The non-mowed area. Sophium terebinthaceum, which is common here. Now the sophium doesn't tell you that too much. It's common here, yes. In fact, a lot. But that's just common everywhere else. They're pretty close, too.
Yeah, it's even dense in other places.
Yeah, it can be quite dense in other places. This, you notice there's a lot in here, most of it without the tall flowering spikes.
Yeah.
Flying stalks. So it's here. There's some Sophium maceniatum, which is also
there's
coming
quite a
here.
A lot of Sophium maceniatum. I'm surprised.
Yeah. Well,
where was the nearest place you planted that?
Look on your map again. On what number is that? Oh yeah, 57-1. That's the.
quite adjacent to the...
Oh, yeah, right there.
And that's the Silphium sinuatum.
That doesn't spread very much, so that's a good marker for you, too.
Yeah. Well, let's go look. Again, not a lot of tall flowering stems, but still it's almost dominant. Now, be sure and come right close to this. You got a lot of these things on your jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And carry them back with you. Now, over to the west of the Silphium lucineatum, there's the 18-3, and that's a rose. I didn't plant the rose, it's a Rosa Carolina, which is a little low one. But I did find when I was planting that there are quite a number of these roses, they grow in patches. And when I found the patch, I just put some stakes around it. Little wooden stakes is what I used those days. And just left that as a natural revegetation rose patch. Which means that soon you get out past the cinuatum, where you should be getting into a patch of roses. Mm-hmm. Now, let's see how well that works. Go out this way and see if you can find roses.
Oh, you see one.
There you are. Right here. That's all the higher they grow. Go on and see if you can find some other roses.
How long, Ted?
50 years.
Lasted 50 years?
Well, that we know about.
Yeah.
Well,
oh, that was...
Marked this area off.
Yeah.
Aren't they nice?
Mm-hmm. One with fruits.
Yeah. That's something to photograph. Yeah, folks, see all those red fruit there.
So, Ted, that was here on old farmland.
On the old farmland.
Mm-hmm. Is this pasture up here? Or?
Old farmland, as far as we're concerned.
Yeah.
It had been allowed to grow up for a year, and I'm not sure it was what the original.
When
and
you find
nobody,
it?
Nobody made a special survey of what was here before.
Mm-hmm.
When you planted, did you just use a just big enough shovel to get the plants in?
Yeah, except the roses were never planted.
The roses were here.
The roses were here.
Oh, I see.
And they just staked them off.
I just put a line around it.
I heard you say you put stakes around them, but I didn't realize they were
here.
I
did put stakes around these others.
Yeah.
Well, I also put stakes around the rose patch roses, too. But just left it. I didn't have to plant it. Or plant it.
So did you put so you didn't put anything into that plot at all, then?
No, I didn't put anything there. I just set aside as a... Natural revegetation, that's what's marked on the map.
Right.
Natural revegetation. Now, the rest of the story. You look for the plants that were here, or you planted in here. But you want to see if they spread out into the other areas, or in what also spread into them. And so what I've been doing is for 18-3, planting 18-3, I gave you your
copy. That's okay.
And this Rosa Carolina. And this is the 12th of September, 90. And roses, the category they've been using, you can't tell anything about the original planting spots as such. So the categories I use are abundant, common, scattered, intermittently, and few or rare. And you just make a guess as to which is which. But certainly the roses here are common. I wouldn't say they're really abundant, but they're common. And so I just write down common.
What are the limits of the area we're looking at right now? How far over are we supposed to be looking? Yeah, I mean, but how far is that?
Oh,
Scale.
Which, that'd be about 15 feet across.
So you think we're at near this corner then?
Yeah, because we just left the Silphium. The Silphium, there's our own right beside it. Right.
but by your pants leg.
There, so somewhere near the vine.
Somewhere, but you have to take into consideration spreading.
Yeah.
And some of the species spread rather widely, and some don't. Well, in this patch of rose, we have the rosa, which is common, and we have lots of andropogon.
We've got a lot of Indian grass.
Have what?
A lot of Indian grass.
Yeah, and sorghastrum. So those affect, there's more of the sorghastrum than there's the andropogon here.
Yeah, Indian grass is really common.
Yeah. It's very interesting to note that sometimes the sorghastrum is much more abundant than the andropogon. In the next place, when the andropogon is more abundant,
Well, does that reflect planting at all?
Not so much. As a matter of fact, they were going that way when we first collected them. And all the planting number two, and we have more of the two than anything else here, it's 211 here, and there's 212 there. The two means andropogon sorghastrum.
Mm-hmm.
We dug them up together and planted them together.
I see.
And so they're mixed in. So some places the sorghastrum took over, and the other places the andropogon took over. Some places they're pretty well mixed, with both of them. And now in this particular case, we also have roos.
Yeah.
Right down, goose. What is that, glabra?
Glabra.
Yeah. It's lovely plant.
And the goldenrod, the solidago.
The solidago.
What, altissima?
Which one?
Altissima. Well, altissima canadensis are lumps.
Okay.
So it's one of
which one does it?
I call it altissima.
You call it altissima.
I think Britain and brown lumps is canadensis also.
Canadensis. I'm going to follow, not written down, I'm going to follow the recent conquest.
Yeah, which was, we can check it out.
Which is a model.
This is the very hairy one.
Taken after the Britain Brown, as the up-to-date version.
Well, there's quite a bit of silphium, parabens, and acium, but I don't know how far over.
Well,
consider.
How would you say it's common or scattered?
Depends on how far over there we go.
I'd say it's common. So, write down silphium, terebinthinaceum. It's also common, it's in with the roses here.
Liatris aspera, which is...
And Liatris aspera is scattered.
Scattered.
Okay, we'll put in scattered here.
What's the small grass down in there? Is that bluegrass?
Most of it will turn out to be cola.
You what, Jenna?
Ooh, Kentucky.
Copensis, probably left over from the old horse pasture days.
You can find koa in just about every quadrat you run.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't been recording that, unfortunately. It's hard to see.
No point in doing it if it's in every one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I see some Monarda.
Monarda, okay. Get Monarda down your list.
I only see one plant.
Well, it's not common. It's scattered in there. And what's this? This panicum?
Panicum brigatum.
Panicum brigatum, that's what I thought. Something for you. Thank you for verifying that. And it's not common. It's scattered. And when I...
Retibida plants without any flowers on it.
Well, that's all right. I don't care about the flowers right at the present time. Common or scattered?
I've only seen one.
Scattered, okay. Retibida. And there's Aster levis there.
There's one.
Oh, here's a rattlesnake master.
Yeah? You know it, don't you?
The rattlesnake, yeah. Well, I've only seen it dried. Oh, and it's starting to get dried, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Eryngium, and it's scattered also.
That's just C1 here.
And then I'll compare this list with the 1982 survey.
Yeah.
And then compare that with the 1946 survey. And also, and when I planned it, I wasn't much ranting of the rosette. And this is
cherry?
Prunus
serotina?
And you can put that in too. You can see the effect of the shading. This is very different here than it is right on there.
Okay. Yeah, you should have that down already.
Is
that a desmodium over there about 10 feet?
Yeah. It is. The desmodium has a insect or fungus of some sort. Lespedeza captea, yeah.
What is this?
That's a nitrous blazing star.
All right.
Nitrous aspera. Okay, that's why I do it.
The only thing I find troubling, Ted, is not knowing, having a better idea, and I'm sure you have a better idea, of where the boundaries are. If you're going to make estimates as to whether it's scattered or not, you really have to know
take a concept to see how abundant it is.
If you know roughly the corners there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a feel for that.
Yeah. Well, you don't have a sense of the scale of this map.
That's right.
But you could pick up on that.
Yeah, you pick that up.
Yeah, I think you probably
have a better feel. I don't know if I've seen it very well. Yeah, Lespedeza is one of the common ones and is widespread in much of the prairie. The nitrous aspera is very widespread, not quite as abundant as the Lespedeza, but there's a lot of it. The Pycnostichia, I don't find too much of it, even where I was looking this morning for the nitrous Pycnostichia, which I planted there, and I could try in most places none at all. So I get right down there in the bottom, and it's just solid down there. I didn't know it when I planted it, but the nitrous Pycnostichia takes the lowland and it spread all over the area there. And then you get the nitrous aspera, and it's up here. So they separate themselves. What's that?
That was one of the first explosions we had of the population.
Oh, which one? Pycnostichia. Mm-hmm. Asclepias aspera. Milkweed. Is one of a narrow leaf and a very slender pod. And verticillata, Asclepias verticillata. And I've planted it several places. It's exploded all over everywhere. Before I left, I couldn't find any. It was an evanescent. It comes up and under disturbance and it just goes wild. I haven't found any, I don't think I found any in 1982. I know I haven't found any this time. And I tried some Incarnata and I haven't seen it either. Well, that was the idea. That's what I do on my survey. Is right. For each planting, I make my list for that particular planting. There were quite a number of them this morning. Looking for sprawlers, I think something that sort, and I say no sprawlers found. This one's gone.
Where are
we
now on this map?
Well, we're sort of on the boundary line between the Athena and the Terebinthinaceae, which is right down here. I think this is apparently Terebinthinaceae mostly here, and the Cineata over here. How much time do you say you want to spend on this?
Oh, I'm at your service here, Ted.
You
want to get on down to your other plot, I suppose.
Yeah, I want to do some that I haven't done before. There's the Retipita, which is scattered in here. And some places the Retipita is abundant where I planted it. And it just dominates the whole thing. But the place I looked in this morning where I set up planted Retipita, I couldn't find anything. So in some places it does very well, and in other places it just disappears completely.
Up any part of this prairie, you get a lot of it.
Yeah. Now, you see, that's the advantage of the bison. bison will just disturb things enough to get some of these things like Elymas and their tibia and others to come in and take over. Now the another effect I've found is the ceanothus, a little shrubby plant. It's a good marker, but you don't see it very much through the prairie. Well, the deer browse it. It's one of the favorite deer browse plants. And they browse it off to about 2 feet high.
Above ground during winter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think the deer probably browse the rose too. The deer like those woody plants. And the roses, I think, are deer browsed. I know the poison ivy is deer browsed. The deer go for poison ivy in a great way. I've seen not here so much, but can't.
I haven't. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, both of them. But we had some down Kansas there, a whole big field of poison ivy. And all chewed off about 12, 15 inches high. And just bitten off right down the line. Quite spread, not very common.
What's that, Ted?
The Euphorbia correlata.
Uh-huh.
But I find it in many of the plantings. Aster, it was quite aster. I can't remember the name of it.
This is wonderful. It's not big enough.
Yeah.
But it's...
it's we're going to have a big one, Ted, over on the Southwest Brady.
Oh,
about
good.
25 acres.
Fine.
Do you remember Jake Jacobson?
Hmm?
Do you remember Jake Jacobson?
No.
He was one of the first supervisors here. And he planted acorns over there in the Southwest Grady. And he spaced them like a savanna.
I see.
And they're now nice, nice round-headed trees,
mm-hmm.
waiting for the prairie to grow underneath.
Originally in this area, most of the prairie you had was savanna prairie rather than open tall grass prairie. Not that there was very much this solid tall grass at that time.
Down at the corner here there's a lot of big blue, real tightly packed. Not much else there. I wonder what that planting history was.
I have no idea. I'm sure I didn't do any heavy planting right. Well, maybe I did.
Not starting sure. Right about here. This wouldn't be a big blue plot, would it?
Could be.
On the right hand side here.
It could be. Mm-hmm. I noticed right down here one little patch of Silphium perfoliatum. Do you have other perfoliatum on the area or not?
Mostly in the new areas we've planted. It seems to do well when we plant it now. So there's quite a bit in here on the left.
Yeah, that's where I saw it. But I haven't seen any out on the open prairie at all.
Continuing this tape, we're back. We're in the McKay Center on the afternoon of Thursday, September 13th, 1990, for a sit-down interview between me, Bill Jordan, and Ted Sperry.
Really, we're getting all the stuff on these cards is to get it well tabulated. And I think about that old notebook that I turned over to Gina, and it's downstairs now.
Yeah.
She says she transcribed them on these sheets here, and she did, but they're sort of summarized and not too well organized the way I'd like them.
It's okay.
Sure. I'd like to get the notebook. I think I'll transcribe my field notes into that notebook. And then once I got them in there in an organized manner, then I wanted to write it up for a rather complete report on the 50-year survey. And then that would have to be rewritten for a paper presentation someplace or other, publication. But my original report will be too long, too detailed for publication. Right. But I want the data down, then we can use it to rewrite it to suit the audience.
Sure. Excellent.
Sorry, my voice isn't quite as good as I would like for it to be. It's kind of dry.
It's picking up pretty well.
Okay.
Would you like to go get a drink or something?
I've just had a couple of them.
What I'd like to do, Ted, is go right back to the beginning, and I'd like you to tell me a little bit about your own background and even when you were a kid and how it was that you got interested in ecology, prairie ecology.
Well, I didn't start school. The first class I attended was in third grade. My mother, we were living out in the country, and mother had been an old school teacher. And so she had me and my brother, and she conducted us her own school.
What school?
Her own school.
Oh.
In the morning. So she had a class of two, my brother and myself. Brother was about a year and a half younger than I was. And she just followed the ritual right on down, had piano, played the songs, and had arithmetic class, and her art class, and history class, things of that sort.
Where were you growing up?
This is the suburbs of Indianapolis, about 2 miles outside the city, in a suburban area.
Yeah.
Fairly wild, the farmland all around us. So, by the time we were ready for the second and third grade, I was in third and brother in second, well, then we could take the interurban car into town and attend the city school. So, went through the regular city schools.
Were you growing up on a farm?
No, suburban.
I see.
There were farmland all around us.
Right.
But we just had a couple of 1 or 2 acres, something
yeah.
sort of country land.
Yeah.
Wooded land, lots of dogwoods and redbud and oaks, hickories, and so forth, around Indianapolis.
Well, where do you trace your interest in the natural?
Oh, well, it was just ordinary school for the grade school, and went to Shortridge High School, which was really good.
What high school?
Shortridge.
Shortridge. Shortridge.
Mm-hmm. Named after Mr. Shortridge. And it was more or less a classical high school compared to the others. They taught calculus and 3 years of Latin, 1 year of Greek in the high school.
Yeah.
And other subjects. We had some 2,000 or 3,000 students. So I had a good high school education. Then I went to Butler University there at Indianapolis. And didn't know what I was going to get into. And took some math first year. And I decided, stayed out a year so to get some money. And then I went back and had a pretty good feel. I knew I was interested in science. I was field in chemistry, so I might as well see what I can get with chemistry. But, it was all right. I like to get outdoors. I played outdoors, worked outdoors all the time anyway. And
as a kid, you mean?
Yeah. And grew up outdoors out there in the country. So, somehow I got in touch with Dr. Friesner. And
Friesner?
Mm-hmm. And he talked me into biology, so I started in my junior in biology, in botany. And Friesner was good. He had some of the top students in the country in his classes. Rex Dobenmeyer, and I had Stanley Kane as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And Potsker there.
What was the first name?
John, I think, John Potsker.
Mm-hmm.
And Willard Clute, the botanist.
Mm-hmm.
He really had a good
group of teachers there. Had, I think, about four years in a row, presidents of the Ecological Society were his students. Well, he was the one that really got me interested in botany. And so I graduated in botany. And I did pretty well. I wasn't a whiz of a student, but did pretty well. Kept my nose to the grindstone. And he talked me into going into graduate school right away, and so I applied to Wisconsin and Illinois. I guess about four or five other schools. But I got replies from both Wisconsin and from Illinois.
And you mean in Urbana? University of Illinois in Urbana?
The University of Illinois and University of Wisconsin here at Madison. But the Illinois one came through first, and I accepted it for the Wisconsin. He then gave me a nod. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin was 2 or 3 weeks later on their acceptances. So I went to Illinois, as I did, and went through graduate school, got my master's and then my doctorate. I had Arthur Bissell, who was the ecologist at Illinois, and so I did my thesis on root systems of prairie plants.
Yeah. Now how did you Weaver and, pick that?
Weaver and Clements had been doing their classic basic work on prairie root systems out in Nebraska. And so talking with Vestal, we came up with the idea of doing something the same thing in Illinois. And so I just followed them as far as Illinois is concerned, instead of the drier land of Nebraska. Illinois had a higher rainfall. And it made a difference that Weaver had published, while I was still in school, I think, is a paper showing that the farther west you went, the shorter the grasses were and the shorter the roots were. And as they went eastward, plants grew taller and the roots went deeper. And then when I got to Illinois, I found the grass grew taller and the roots were shorter.
Shorter?
Yeah. Why? Because in Illinois they had a water table. And they went down to the water table. And as the water table came up, well, the roots just went down and stopped at the water table. So that was actually the gist of my doctor's thesis.
Well, now, how did you study the roots?
Hmm?
What techniques were you using?
How would you find what the roots did if you were after them? Mm-hmm. Use a shovel.
Dig down.
They dig a pit 5-6 feet deep.
Yeah.
And go down as far as the roots go.
And just follow the roots down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Grade them. Tease them out of the soil.
Yeah. Use a nice pick. Got them out of the soil.
Yeah.
That's the hardest slow way afterwards. Some of us tried washing the roots, but the soil just pulled the roots pulled them apart with the washing. That washing technique didn't work bit well. The method I used was hard enough.
Was that hard work?
Well, not too hard. It was tedious mostly. It was the job of digging the soil out all the time, throwing it out, but it was getting the roots of the soil loose from the roots and keeping the roots intact.
Yeah.
That was the job.
Yeah. And untangling.
Yeah.
The different species. Mm-hmm. Huh?
So
you made a contribution to the development of the prairie ecology tradition.
I was a prairie ecologist for my graduate work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I published it.
Excuse me, Ted. We were talking about the root research.
Well, yeah. When I got out of school, remember that was 1933.
Right.
The bottom of the depression, there weren't any jobs anyplace. But the CCC project was just getting started under Roosevelt. And the conservation groups, especially in the Forest Service, they had a new forest in southern Illinois, just creating one. And they had CCC camps there, and they referred me to them, so I applied and got a job with the Forest Service, working down there. In the meantime, I was the survey.
Where was that?
the Shawnee National Forest.
Cheyenne?
The Shawnee.
Shawnee in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't called Shawnee back in the old days. It was the Shawnee Purchase Unit and the Illini Purchase Unit.
What and were you doing with them?
The foreman in the camp, mm-hmm. working on forest, doing forest survey, really. The reason for the survey is they wanted evaluation on the land for purchase of the forest by the federal government, established forest. And so we were doing the forest survey work.
Yeah.
It was actually cruising timber. That's what it wanted to be mostly. In my spare time, I rewrote my doctorate thesis for publication. A doctorate thesis is one thing, and publication is something else again.
Yeah.
And I wrote up for submission to Journal of Ecology. And the editor accepted it right away. Took me a year more or less to rewrite it and for him to get through it and get it into publication. And that was about 1935 by the time that it came out. And 35 is just the time when Elder Leopold was looking for a prairie ecologist to manage a prairie here. On the other foreman, they had the camp that had just been established. And they could get foremen for their landscape architecture and for forestry and wildlife from here in Wisconsin. No prairie ecologists in Wisconsin at all. There weren't many prairie ecologists any place. They were scarce commodities in those days.
Yeah.
There were a few, but usually at the university or something. But I was the prairie ecologist that was working with in the forest. And Leopold asked me if I'd be interested. I said I would.
He saw your paper.
He read my paper in ecology. And he asked in his letter what a prairie ecologist is doing down the Forest Service. But he didn't have to ask that very seriously because he'd been with the Forest Service himself for a few years.
When did you get that? Do you remember getting that letter?
I probably still have it at home, I suspect.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel?
I didn't know much about prairie projects or prairie ecology, even if I had been working on the root systems. But
had you heard of Leopold before?
Yeah, I had. Well, he wasn't well known, but he was. His book came out, Game Management, out in 1933. And so he was known as the author of the book, at least. And I said I would, and then I didn't hear anything from him at all. Nothing. And I figured the project just hadn't materialized at all. And I discovered later what the reason was, and you've already read it in your that paper we published.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Tell me, at this point, were you married yet?
I married the year after I got my doctorate.
In 34?
No, 35, 2 years after. I got my doctorate in 33 and met my wife there in the botany department in Illinois. And she got her doctorate in 1934. And we both had to get out and earn some money so as to be able to afford to get married.
Yeah.
So she got a teaching job right away.
Teaching in a college?
Her hometown is Decatur, Illinois. And they have James Millikan University, which is just a little small college.
Millikan?
Mm-hmm. And that's where she'd done her undergraduate work, and she got a teaching job there.
Yeah.
So, I was commuting.
So you were married at the time you were working for the Forest Service?
I was married at the time that I was working for at the Forest Service, yes. Yeah. I got, and we...
Well, then you were you able to live together when you were working for the CCC there, for the Forest Service?
No, she was teaching there at Decatur, and I was working down Shawnee, or what was the town? Harrisburg. Jonesboro, actually, is where I first started, and went over to Harrisburg afterwards.
Yeah.
With the Forest Service, no, I commuted back and forth.
Yeah. Weekends, you mean?
Whenever we had a holiday or some weekends.
So by train or car?
I drove back at Model T Ford.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So you had a car at that point?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I sort of had to have a car to get around. And so the first money I made, got the car for transportation. And we used it for getting back and forth and romancing.
Yeah.
And we got married, we went back to Urbana and got married at Urbana. Neither at Decatur nor at Jonesboro.
Mm-hmm.
We went back there, our little church we attended there at the University town.
Yeah.
Married in the University Church.
So late in 1935, you accepted an offer to come up here.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't get my offer until 1936. I was offered the job in 35, but nothing happened. And it was February of 36 before I heard from Leopold again.
Right.
And he said the job had materialized, and so they had already terminated my position there, so as to transfer me up here to the Park Service.
Yeah.
Okay. It actually is just a transfer from the Forest Service to the Park Service.
Tell me again, just for the tape here, how you came into Madison and found the camp and so on.
Well, letter, I guess, a telegram first, I believe, from Leopold's, and then a letter telling him that the job had materialized here, and so they gave me a couple weeks to finish there and move out of quarters there in Harrisburg up to Decatur. And wife had a little house there in Decatur. We dumped all my stuff there, and I came out of here in Madison and got up to into Wisconsin, ran into one of the big Wisconsin snowstorms.
Yeah.
It was 0 degree weather, and they'd had 2 feet of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
And I came up by train. We just had the one car and left it on there for her.
Right.
I came up to Chicago and out of Madison. And it was about the time the second semester starting approximately. And there were lots of students there. I got off the train, and all the students were wanting transportation with taxi cabs home, or wherever they're living. And I had to wait an hour before I could get a taxi cab. When they found out I wanted to go up to Camp Madison, they called it, they were too busy. I had local business first. Finally got a cab rather late at the evening. It was 10 o'clock at night or something sort. And he said he'd see what he could do. And they had the roads open, just enough two-wheel tracks. And once in a while, it'd be wide enough so you could get two cars past each other. Just the two tracks, and they got out to the entrance, and that's as far as it went. And there on, just had a path going into the camp here. And so he dumped me out there in the country someplace, and I took a bag and walked in here. And saw the Park Service sign up here on the old farmhouse. But it was locked up tight, nobody around. But I was sitting right down just past this building here. It was the headquarters of the Army Barracks. And it had a light on. Sure enough, there was some guy on duty there, supposed to be. And he'd never heard of me and didn't know anything about it at all. But apparently I was qualified as a service foreman, Park Service foreman. and I think I was probably wearing my uniform for the Park Service, Forest Service, about the same thing. And the Park Service did have one barracks for the park foreman. And he went up there and fixed me up a cot and was okay for the night. And next morning when I met one or two of the men who were down there, and they had never heard of me either, didn't know anything about it. But they introduced me to the superintendent when he came in. It was supposed to be at 8 o'clock. It was after that before they got through the snow drifts to get up there. And got me introduced. He had heard, you know, there's somebody supposed to be coming in on for the prairie job. He didn't know anything about it either. It was Harold Madden. Did you know him? He knew. Mm-hmm. And he called up Bonecker, somebody at the university. And yes, they were interested. And they said, by all means. And they get him established there, so I've got a couple of days to get established on the camp routine here and quarters and wait till they got their paths dug out of the snow. And a couple of days later, somebody from the university, I guess Longenecker himself, came out here to get me and take me back to the university. And they had an interview with him there and with Leopold there. All they knew about me is that I'd gotten a degree at Illinois and was apparently qualified in county ecology. And they wanted to interview me and see how I might work out. Hopefully I'd work out some way and what my background was. That's I spent, I suppose, most of the morning there at the university. And talking with Passett, too. Passett, the plant taxonomist.
Mm-hmm. So that worked out all right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the understanding was that you would do what?
Be in charge of the prairie project.
Specific?
Yeah. That's the reason I was brought up here, because they didn't have anybody that could plant this prairie here. And Leopold, who was actually administrative in charge of the operations out here, I don't mean Leopold Longenecker, in charge of the operations here, he didn't know anything about prairies either. The only reason he put a prairie there is because Leopold told him and thought it would be a good idea, and he went along with it. But when they talked prairie, he turned me over to Leopold at once. And Leopold hadn't done a lot with prairies, but he'd been working with Forest Service and worked out in Arizona, New Mexico, and knew what the deserts were like and the grasslands were like. And he was a pretty well-read man in the first place. So that he had more or less an idea of what it would be like to put a prairie in. Where he got the idea of having a prairie there, I don't know, except that somebody there in the botany department had been working on vegetation types in Wisconsin and found that the prairie was an important vegetation type in the southwestern part of the state. And so that seemed to Leopold to be a good idea to establish that vegetation type. And as I said, noted in my paper, the prairie was the type that was present here, and be a good idea to establish it, but nobody has studied it very intently and noticed what should be done to develop it. But Longenecker actually liked the idea because it was the low vegetation, and he was interested in these forest types. He was a forest man primarily, and he wanted these pine forest and the maple forest and so forth, hardwood forest, in various places, and looking at the over the prairie to see the forest, well, you could actually see them that way. I mean, you just got into the forest, and the problem was you can't see the forest because of the trees.
So it made a nice perspective.
And so is the perspective that Longneck Rose is interested in for the prairie. He assumed it was grasses, gave him a view of the prairie. But Leopold was the one that's really more interested in it as a vegetation type, especially for the game. He's primarily interested in game.
Do you remember what he said to you when he introduced the project?
I have the slightest idea. General gist of it was, we would like to get a prairie established here, and we have 60 acres out here of this old farmland. Not very good. That's the reason the guys sold it. And we have a camp established there. They'll have a truck, and we got a dozen of the CCC men with long-handled shovels go out there and make a prairie out of it. That's essentially all the instructions I had. I suppose Tatton was the one that, I don't mean Tatton, Facet. Facet was the one that could tell me more about the prairie plants than anybody else.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Because he was interested in all the various types. His specialty later was water plants, aquatic plants. Mm-hmm. But he was fairly well up on the prairie, too. So they're the ones that not told me so much what the prairie was, because I'd already found that out in Illinois. Sure. Been working for it with the prairie for 2-3 years down there. But on the Wisconsin manifestations of the prairie, actually it is a bit more savanna here than it was down there. Mm-hmm. Although back in those days, savanna, well, it was known, it was not very much emphasized. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most of them didn't even think of savanna as a type all of its own. In fact, I didn't find a real interest in savanna until this last grassland meeting, when they had a whole section just on savannas as contrast to the rest of the prairie. And so they're now dividing it into the prairies, the true prairies, and savannas, which is what it should be. And the early travelers coming through here didn't talk about the prairie so much, except the difficulty getting through it, but they talked about the savannas. Because there they had trees, they had wood, and they had shelter, and they didn't have the heavy grass to get through that they had out in the open prairie itself. So the early travelers went from one savanna to the next to the next, and just plowed up tunnels through the prairie to get to them.
Right.
And apparently even the game preferred the savannas to oak prairie.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or the big old bison. They could go through anything.
Right.
They did.
Yeah. Did you work... So tell me about how you went about that work.
What we were looking for is some prairie that we could transplant. That was the first idea. And I don't know who